Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your co-hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. Welcome to 2026, I guess.
Oh my gosh, yes, it's a new year.
Not the first episode that we've put up here, but the first one we've recorded this year. I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games. I've made a bunch of role-playing games and a card game. And we have a returning guest here. It is the episode of Campbell's Unite. Spencer Campbell is here, no relation. But hey, Spencer, welcome back.
Thank you. You never know. You never know about the no relation thing. The Campbell clan got messy back in Scotland. You just never can tell.
It's on purpose.
I can tell you 100% then that's the case, because you trace your lineage to Scotland. I trace none of my lineage to Scotland. The name was changed at Ellis Island because it was an unfamiliar German name. And the people said, oh, Campbell. And that's where we became the Campbells.
That's what they say, so you don't go after the soup empire.
They made that up to protect us from the McDonald's, because the Campbell McDonald rivalry from hundreds of years ago.
Fun fact about that: my mom is a McDonald's, my dad is a Campbell.
Whoa,
West Side story.
You're like the product of Hatfields and McCoys.
Yes, and that was something that we talked about a lot when we were in Scotland back in 2017. The Scots got a big kick out of that one. They loved that story. Anyway, I'm Spencer Campbell. I'm a tabletop role-playing game designer. I publish games under the name Gila RPGs. You might know some of my stuff like the Lumen System or Slayers or Rune. I'm really excited to be here and to chat with y'all.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Those all sound like your own system that you've made. It's not that I've totally never read those before. It sounds like they're indie games of your own design?
They certainly are. They are indie games. In fact, a whole system that I designed, every single one of them, were systems that I designed in-house.
Craig, why am I being so weird about pretending that I've never read any of Spencer's games?
Well, because you've read some. what we're getting to today is, and we've talked, this is a topic that comes up quite a bit because it's a very broad topic. There's a lot of different paths we can follow and dig around in. And we're going to talk about game design again, designing your own system. I'm sure we'll kind of delve into different realms on it. But one of the things we can use as a guiding principle here is, like, how do we handle balance within designing our own game? And balance can mean a lot of things. It can be power balance, it can be fun balance, engagement balance. What do you want to try to do to balance certain aspects? There are some people that are like, well, I don't care about power, I just want to make sure that every character type, every build is fun. Like, if one character is more powerful than another, so be it. Like, they're still having fun. But we can talk about that from a game design perspective.
Yeah. Spencer, it might be obvious, but what drew you to this topic on our list of topics?
The reason I'm drawn to it is because I famously, in many of my books, say that you shouldn't seek balance in games. And I think, to speak to what kind of Craig was mentioning, there's many different types of balance. And when I say you shouldn't have balance in your games, I'm specifically talking about fair fights, combat balance, because there, if you play D&D, you're probably very familiar with the concept of, like, challenge ratings and fair fights and the number of different encounters you're supposed to have, and crafting your encounters to with all these fancy magic math and numbers. And if we were being realistic about life, nobody would ever fight fair ever. Like, nobody would ever want to go into a fight that is a fair fight. They would want to go into a fight that they know, I'm going to win this fight. And so this desire to seek these well-crafted, balanced combat encounters always seemed really strange to me. So while that's an element of balance that I largely kind of just hand wave away, and that's reflected in things like my Lumen system, which is very power fantasy, very much like the players are going to win. There's no question if the players are going to win. They're going to win. to other types of balance that are more interesting to me, like the balance of cognitive load of our different character types or class types at the table and how we can accommodate very different play styles within the same game, rather than having to make sacrifices or negotiate systems that we're going to choose based off of what is maybe like a happy medium for all of us. And that's the stuff that I think is more interesting, mostly because I'm a cognitive psychologist. So I think a lot about cognitive load and executive function and decision-making, creativity and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, even in games that purport to be very balanced, you are going to have, like, for example, let me think of a game that pretends that it's very balanced. Let's say D&D. It is not, because if you play one sort of character versus another kind of character, you are doing more cognitive load. You're like, I remember the first time I tried to play a wizard when I was like 13. I was like, this is too much for me right now. I'm not going to do this. This is not as fun for me. It's taking more of the energy than I want to expend on this character. I'm spending, speaking of time balance, I'm spending like 3 minutes trying to figure out what I'm going to do next in this fight. That is, I think, a balance that a lot of us don't really think about when we're designing our cool indie systems. Like, what's the balance like between like the play time, like when you're actually engaged in the role playing, versus the read time when you're engaged in the mechanics, which can be fun for some people for sure. I mean, but that starts to feel a little bit more like a board game to me than a tabletop role-playing game.
Well, see, like, it's interesting you mentioned board games, because to me, board games is the inspiration for how I like approach the idea of balance of cognitive load at the table, specifically with like my Slayers system. So Slayers and Dragon Slayers are these games that I've created. And the entire premise of them is that each class is very asymmetrically designed, meaning each class has their own unique mini game, essentially, that they're playing in combat that's totally different than everybody else. And I stole this concept from board games, from specifically leader games. So if you're familiar with like Root or Arx or Oath, fantastic board games. And Root is a game that like really got its like hooks in my head a long time ago. It's an area control board game of fantasy critters basically trying to control a forest, but every faction that you can choose from plays totally differently. So like one person's playing like a very Euro style engine building game, while another person is playing a singular raccoon that's running around the forest stealing junk and trading it and stuff like that. And those two players are sitting at the same table playing the same game, but wildly different from one another. And that lets two different people who have very different preferences of complexity of play to play the same game. And that was something that I wanted to sort of capture with Slayers. Is you're describing the scenario of like, okay, there's a wizard that's like super complex, and then maybe like a fighter that's a little bit more straightforward. If we just really lean into this idea of like, okay, there's just going to be some classes that are more complex, but now you can kind of choose, like, I want the one that has more buttons and levers to pull, and I want the one that's just one button that I push over and over again. Like, creating that scenario in a role-playing game lets me play Slayers with people who have very different preferences of complexity in their role-playing games. And so, board games turns out is the major inspiration for me when it comes to thinking about that sort of stuff.
This is reminding me a lot of teaching. There's the idea of like a universal lesson planning, universal design of learning that we're supposed to achieve as teachers. Well, some people think that we're supposed to achieve as teachers, like design this lesson plan that's going to work for literally every one of your students. But in reality, when you do that, you have to go through and be like, okay, well, yeah, I can design it for every single one of my students, but there's no one size fits all for them. This person likes to do this in this way. This person can never focus. They need to be able to stand up sometimes. This person is struggling with reading. I need to make sure that I have some scaffolds for them. And I think my personal philosophy is that teaching and game design are basically the same thing. Same thing with GMing and teaching. There's a lot that cross over. And I'm curious, Spencer, did you play the role-playing game Root? Does it do that in the role-playing game?
I never played the role-playing game. No. So I have no, all I know is it's a PBTA game. That's about as far as I know about.
That's what I know.
Mm-hmm. So my guess is that it is not like that. But I don't know. I can't speak with any authority, but I will echo your, oh, go ahead, Craig.
It could be, we have to go do some research, buy a game, read it. Oh, darn.
I mean, with the thing, with the Powered by the Apocalypse game, they're all the same. They have the mechanic resolution is the same.
Right. The mechanic resolution is the same, but like what you're doing in your mechanics can be very, very different from character to character. Like each character archetype, each playbook is its own thing. So you can have a character that's like, this is the character that does these things really well and just falls back to basic moves to do other things. And then you have another character that does these other things really well, and which is not terribly unlike what Spencer's talking about for Slayers, where, you know, each of the character archetype that you're playing kind of has their thing that they do. The mechanically, game mechanic wise, it's the same resolution system, but you can have wildly different kind of capabilities within that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just want to say, Jess, as an educator, I fully understand the difficulties of trying to create the perfect universal situation. I was a professor of psychology in higher ed for about 10 years, and my background is in cog psych and in learning sciences. So specifically the science behind how we learn, and this desire to create a universal approach just flies in the face of decades and decades of research. And it's very frustrating that it's something that we seek. That we got to get people reading some more Vygotsky. I think that's what we need to do. That'll solve things to get into our learning theory.
As an architect, I run into a similar situation, which is we're always dealing with accessibility and making sure that the building is accessible in all different ways for different people of different capabilities. And that is equally frustrating because there is no catch-all. Like, even if you follow all the ADA codes, there's going to be like some people that are going to be kind of outliers that are going to be like, this still doesn't really do the job for people like me. And so, making anything catch-all, making making anything be kind of perfectly synced and balanced, where you've got this, think of it as a plate on a pin where it's just perfectly balanced. And however you arrange things on top of the plate, you shift the center of mass and it still remains balanced. See, because you got to have enough of this to be able to offset that. I personally don't particularly care about power balance. I have at times. There have been times where I've been very concerned about it, and I think there's probably a few of my games that actually kind of do embrace the idea. But mostly, I kind of focus more on like, is every kind of build that is going to be enjoyable to play? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to build an accidentally like boring character that doesn't do anything very well, and make sure that like everything you're offering the players gives them enough of, whether that's like gives them enough cool things to do that they find enjoyable, that the player can choose a playbook or, you know, an archetype or whatever, or they can build with a point system or whatever to get, you know, exactly what they want and have all those things work fine. And I'm sure that there are some people that would argue, like in Capers, because there's a lot of abilities, a lot of powers, everything, you could accidentally build a character that's kind of like boring, but you can also, you know, fix that character. And but for at the same time, every player has a different mindset. So like, if I play a Capers character that has nothing but minor powers only at level one, it means I can't do anything incredibly well, but I can do so many cool things. And you become like you have a jack of all trades character who's like, I've enjoyed playing that type of character many times. I usually refer to them as the Swiss Army character. You know, like if the group is like, oh, we've got this thing we have to deal with, and nobody has like the perfect tool for it, I was like, well, I can probably cobble something together from this little array of abilities and magic items and spells and, you know, whatever else I have to be able to kind of deal with this.
I wonder if like that idea, that kind of striving for balance that a lot of game designers are still pursuing. And I wonder if that comes out of the idea of an adversarial relationship between the GM and the players. It doesn't really fit as, I mean, it maybe I'm sort of thinking about this off the top of my head, so forgive me while I stew on it a little bit, but in a game where I'm competing against another player, like if I'm playing a board game or a card game where I should be able to win, let me think about Cosmic Encounters is a game that my husband and his family like to play. And all of those characters are very different. Like all the little factions, the alien factions all have their own different mechanic. They have their own different win things. However, each of them kind of have an equal chance of winning by the end. It just depends on how smart you're playing. And I think that's important when you're playing an adversarial game, because you don't want to feel like, great, now I'm fucked and I can't do anything. It's not really the same for a tabletop game where, at least in the modern philosophy of game running, you as a GM are not an opponent in many games. You're not an opponent to the players. So it doesn't matter if the game is imbalanced towards you. I think what matters more is that do the players feel like there's a balance between risk and reward? Is there a balance between the idea of like success or what I have to give up for success? And I'm thinking while I'm saying that, like about games that don't necessarily have that same sort of GM relationship with like the GM and the players, like a solo game or a GMless game or a LARP even. I wonder like how much more or less balance might be important for a game like that. I mean, especially a GMless game where there's no like mediator really.
I mean, there's just a certain culture of play in those sorts of games where like there's sort of an understanding at the table of we're doing something. This is a collaborative process, even if there are different roles that we're playing at the table and there is a GM here. Like so many books nowadays reinforce the idea that the GM is a player at the mm-hmm. table, right? And this is not a PvP game, unless it is explicitly a PvP game. And since it's not a PvP game, you are not against the GM. And GM, you are not against the players, which means, you know, it is about establishing what is this game about and how have the tools been provided to help you accomplish that. And if this game is about the players getting kicked over and over again because it's really difficult, then that's what the game is about, and you know going into it. And if this game is about the players are going to kick the GM's butt over and over again, we've announced this ahead of time and you are all ostensibly working together to play a game together, hopefully. I see it a lot more in books, this just emphasizing this idea that the GM is a player at the table, and like this very concept of like trusting the table, which I think I appreciate and I like. I see some people think that is very hand wavy when people leave like things in the rules that say like, if this doesn't work for your table, change it to fit your table. Some people don't like that. They want like something very prescriptive, but I don't see that as a particularly bad thing. I see that as a strength of our medium compared to like a board game, right? Like you're describing Cosmic Encounters. It would be awful if the rulebook said, "Yeah, if this doesn't work, I don't know, figure it out yourselves." Like that would not be good.
I mean, it would also not be good if you were playing Cosmic Encounters and weren't trying to win and screw over your other fellow players. That game doesn't work that way. Like if you're all trying to play a combative game cooperatively, you're not really playing the game. I like what you said, like this culture of play, while having a culture of play might not necessarily be completely designed mechanically, you can't enforce a culture with mechanics. But the fact that you're saying like, here, this is how the game, this is what you're supposed to be doing in the game, like that is part of the game design. I mean, I think that's why so many people also hold on so hard to the what is a tabletop game? What is this tabletop game in their books? Because what they're really doing is setting up a culture of play, which I wish that LARPers sometimes would understand more, that we are not really fighting against each other. It's like, you can't win this. I mean, it's not a win game. But, you know, that for a LARP is a completely different story in that case. So.
I've had you know, I put that sentence or paragraph into a number of my games where, you know, it's like the rules fill, you know, the rules fill a bunch of different gaps, and any gaps that they don't fill, you are free to fill. And you're also free to adjust things for your group's play style. And I've very early in all the game design stuff and everything, I got into discussions about people saying, who seemed adamant that you don't need to give the players permission. Like, you never need to write something in the game that's like giving them permission, because you're being kind of presumptive and a little hoity-toity and being like, I'm the game designer and I'm granting you the ability to modify my game. But I would argue that that's not the point of it. The argument of is to set an expectation for what the game is about and how the game system can be used. And when you include that information in there, it could help to kind of nudge a particular player in the group, even if that player is the GM, to be like, be a little more accepting to the ideas, because like we're playing this game, we all agreed to play this game, and the game says we can do these types of things. And so rather than pushing back against that, because I've played in games where the GM said, no, this is how it is, rules is written, blah blah blah, never rules as intended, and if there's not a rule for it, then you can't do it. And that's how, you know, like those sorts of kind of far-reaching statements that some people might make when they don't want to go down the road of, you know, modifying your house ruling. And that's true. We all know that, like, groups have house ruled forever and they've modified the system to their own accord. But I think it's useful to put it in the game book, because not because it's giving them permission, but it's reinforcing what the system is supposed to be about. Like, I don't think I have that statement in Die Laughing, because if you, the system is so straightforward, it does precisely two things. It determines how well your character does in a scene, like what the outcome of a scene is for your character, and it determines how quickly you die. And if you go in there and start tweaking that stuff, it actually changes the very fundamental nature of the game, because the game is supposed to bleed characters out. It's supposed to make sure that we have, okay, by the time we hit act two, somebody's going to die. By the time we hit act three, probably half the group is going to be dead and they're all going to be playing producers or whatever. Because the system is designed to, you know, do a very specific thing. Whereas, you know, Capers is just like, you know, if you think this particular power is too weak, you know, for your group, for how you play, it, boost it, make, you know, make it cooler. So yeah, there's, that's kind of my approach when it comes to power balance. And I would much rather kind of roll toward fun balance, or when I made the comment at the beginning, was engagement balance, which is kind of how the game keeps people engaged. Not to say that it's bad for a player to be flipping through their phone when it's not their turn in combat or whatever. People have, you know, different levels of neurospiciness.
By death in my table.
Right.
I'm joking.
but you know, if you can do something with the game that helps to keep it engaging in some way, shape, or form, that's, you know, like the way I've done initiative in the Roll Track System games is to have initiative kind of get passed from one player to another person in that moment. And so when it gets around to your turn, you know, Jess could go, give me my turn. Now it's the end of the round. And I say, okay, at the beginning of the next round, Jess goes again. So like immediately Jess has something to do. So the situation hasn't changed much. So you didn't have to engage. You're like, oh, the combat situation or the social situation that we're dealing with is largely what it was, you know, a turn ago. But if you get separated with a lot of people taking turns in there, then like it can all change very, very drastically. And I'm not trying to get you to get off your phone, but I'm hoping that we get the, you know, treat the table like one of your screens. We have the, you know, the talk about that, because a two screen society that we live in now, people like watch TV and are on their phone at the same time, and Netflix movies are being criticized for restating the plot three and four times because people are paying. Yeah, that's just how they are. And I think with gameplay, this, it can be the same way. You can be doing something on your phone or you know, crunching some numbers or figuring out what your next purchase is going to be or whatever it is that kind of helps you fill the time and kind of in between before you have to take the, you know, your action. But if I do it in such a way where the initiative could come back to you at any moment, hopefully I'm instilling in you, keep one ear listening to what's going on, because it could be your turn any moment. Rather than knowing that, okay, I've taken my turn and it's going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 turns before I go again, when I go around the table and count the players. So, and then because I've run into that, that's the one that bothers me at the table as a GM, is if we get around to the person coming around again and they go, oh, what's going on?
Yeah.
Like keep an ear so that, you know, like, well, your character is in imminent peril. Like I just described that at the end of the other person's turn, and now it's your turn to deal with the imminent peril. So like, I just try to make sure that there's a level of engagement that's provided within the game, no matter how you build the character, no matter how you play the game, that there's like something that's going to kind of keep you somewhat engaged. And I've had people tell me too, like with playbook stuff, where if you've got games that have like currencies that you're gaining and losing all the time, so you're always kind of interacting with your character sheet or with a scratch pad or whatever, that's very engaging as well. And there are people that really like those types of games where it's like, I'm always kind of in this character. I'm always thinking, oh, I've got these many points, this, and I've got this many, you know, this much spirit and this much, you know, this much mm-hmm. money and this much mana, you know, this many mana points and your superpower points or whatever. And you know that you can utilize all those things in a lot of different ways, but you're also paying attention to everything that's going on. So there's a fun and engagement kind of thing. And it's less so about whether or not one character can blow somebody up and the other character can't.
It's interesting we talk about the like engagement thing. And I think, you know, for the most part, I think we're generally talking about it in a combat sense, right? Like, how do we keep people engaged in combat when outside of combat, I wonder if we run in, if we have similar sorts of issues of players staying engaged when we're doing any of the other pillars that are not combat, right?
I've absolutely 100% seen that. I've seen it in this very specific form.
Yeah.
I played in a D&D game. It happened in the evenings after, you know, after work, we'd all go, we'd have dinner at the place and then we'd play. One of the guys who was in the group played a combat monster. He loved playing combat characters. He worked a very physically demanding job. So he would literally half the time doze off during social encounters, because that was not the thing he was interested in being engaged in. And he was tired as hell from his physically demanding job. And we would just wake him up when combat broke out. And we were all, that was the culture at the table. That's how we got along. But there's absolutely people who kind of disconnect if it's not like killing bugbears.
Oh yeah, totally. I get that. And I just, in that exact example, it sounds to me like it's not a problem, right? Like we all, like you said, the table understands like, okay, this guy is tired. and he wants to play a very specific kind of game. He wants to play a combat game. So let's let him power off, so to speak, in the non-combat stuff and then hop into the combat stuff. You know, it's the same. When it's like speaking to the combat engagement stuff, for me, when I try and keep, because my games are very combat focused. If anybody's ever read my games are about fighting things. And
game called Players? What?
I know, right? how do you keep somebody engaged in a combat scenario when, like, notoriously we have games like D&D where people get disengaged, is I just limit people's options for what they can do. So then we don't run into sort of the analysis paralysis where in like a game like Nova or a Lumen game, you have 4 choices and that's it. You have 4 powers and that's what you're going to do on one of those on your turn, which means, but all 4 are very cool. They're all do cool shit buttons that you get to push over and over and over again. And if you just give them 4 buttons instead of 15 buttons, people stay engaged because they're like, I'm ready to I want to push this button so badly. Is it my turn yet? Because I'm going to push the button and it's going to do something immediately and effective. And so for me, when it comes to keeping players engaged in combat, it's actually limiting options rather than giving you more things to do. It's exactly the scenario like Jesse, you were describing, where you are a wizard and you've got a billion different things for you to figure out when it's your turn to roll into combat, because the wizard is way more complex than I swing sword again now. when you're playing a fighter. So I think there's also something to be said about constraining options for players in terms of an ability not only to balance the fairness of a fight and things like that, because there's less variables for you to track, but also it will help keep players focused, because now they know, okay, I only need to keep track of these four things or X number of things. You know, if you look at a Slayer's character, they basically have like two things that they can choose from during their turn. And that's very intentional, so that you just know, like, okay, my character is very good at X. And so I will do everything I can on my turn to put myself in a situation where I can do X. And then I execute that when it's my turn. And then I wipe my hands clean of my turn and I move on to the next thing. And so I think there is something to be said about constraining our characters to keep people engaged rather than giving them more and more and more options. There's definitely a place for more and more options. For the people who love that build crafting, ooh, it's so good. It's so delicious. But I'm not one to try and make somebody's forever game, which means I don't need to think of a million different ways that your character can advance and the spreading skill tree and stuff like that. I want you to play my game for like five or six sessions and then go to something else, go play another game. And so that means I can keep the focus of balance and engagement on, like, you're going to have a really good time for like five times. And then you're going to be like, I think I've got this game. I'm ready to move on.
Right. I think there's an example of like that mentality and thinking about things that way too with D&D, even though D&D can become very, very complex. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to high levels, you've got lots, you know, wizards and sorcerers have lots and lots of spells. They've got lots of magic items. They've got all sorts of options, but there's also you know, you hear the results of polls all the time, like, well, what level do you tend to play your campaigns to? And like, you know, 85% of campaigns wrap up before eighth level. And that might be in part because, like, well, that's how long it took to tell like this cool story that the GM wanted to tell. But it also might be that's the point where like people, we just got too much and it just becomes kind of cumbersome to play the game for us, for my group. You know, whereas there are certainly players that'll be like, I can't wait to hit 17th level, you know, and have 9th level spells. But for Spencer, you do it very specifically. It's like, this game does this thing. I'm not expanding it into high levels because I'm not intending to give different play experiences like that. I'm intending to give this play experience.
For me, I've been thinking a lot about pacing in the game. Like, how are we pacing the play cycle of a game, and making sure that you're designing that intentionally too? Because I think that balance is super important. Like, what does, if you are meant to be playing this game for only five or six sessions, what does that arc look like when they're sitting down to play? How long does it take for somebody to play an arc of a play cycle? Or I guess a cycle of a play cycle in your game, especially with, you know, like a solo game. I've played a lot of solo games where I feel like I'm doing the same thing over and over and over and over again until, I don't know. It's like finding like, how am I designing my mechanics to go from here's this phase to this phase, and hitting the promise of the game. Like, the promise of the game is we're going out and we're going to go kill monsters. How am I making sure that we hit that flow and then get a denouement and then wrap up that denouement before we build up to the other, to the next climax of the game, to the next time we kill a monster. I think that's a really big challenge for a game designer, because you're sort of, you have to like have your mechanics in play to influence, if it's a GM'd game, influence jamming style or influencing the flow. Some people do it with timers or clocks or like specific like success requirements. But some games I've played, I don't feel like the designer has thought about that at all. They've thought about, here's my cool mechanic that they're going to engage with, but they haven't thought about when they're engaging with that mechanic through while they're like spending time with the game. That's, I think, what makes a lot of games fall flat for me nowadays, at least.
I love a clearly defined cycle of play in a game. I love it so much. You know, I remember reading and playing a bunch of games for a long time. And it was when I read Blades in the Dark, and John has a very clear cycle by which this game is supposed to be played. And not just like, is it described in the game, but he even talks about like the first time you do this, it's probably going to take you about this long to accomplish the various phases of this cycle. When you become more familiar, you might be able to accomplish X, Y, and Z in the cycle in a single session. And like very overtly saying, this is how, these are the various phases and the very specific mechanics in which in each of these phases that you will engage with, and like a timeline by which you might accomplish these things, I found very, very helpful. Obviously, everyone's table will vary in how much they want to engage with those phases or how long they spend in each one. But I definitely saw that and started to try and put that into my games, not quite as overtly as John did, but like I do find it valuable to say these are basically the different modes of play that you will engage with, and this is approximately the one that you will spend the most time on, and this is the thing that you'll spend the least amount of time on, and I think that can be very helpful to set those expectations of, if this is a 5-session campaign, how will one accomplish that? Well, if we follow this sort of recipe, it should, in theory, create a cake at the end. If you do jazz with the recipe and play fast and loose, I don't know what kind of cake you're going to have at the end, but you'll certainly have made something.
You'll put some ingredients in a bowl and heated them up. We don't know.
So I quite like that sort of stuff in my games,
and I think that plays to. It helps to assuage the concerns of certain types of people who perhaps don't, like, you know, some people say, like, I can't really play a game until I play it. Like, I can't, reading about it, I'm not going to learn how to play this game by reading. I'm going to need to play. And then they also find themselves in the position of, like, am I, quote unquote, doing it right? Like, am I doing what the game is supposed to be doing? Am I doing what the designer intended? And if you put that type of stuff in there and you say, here's the phases of play, here's how long things are going to go. And then when you play, you see like, oh, that's actually what's happening. Now I feel like I'm doing this right because I'm doing exactly what the author told me. This is how this goes. And then it gets a little faster as we get better with it. And I think that helps to give people a sense of security and confidence that they're kind of doing things right, that they're not, like, you know, missing some important point or like screwing up, you know, something important about the game. And it also puts everyone in the position of like everybody is on the, it puts everybody on the same page. Like everybody's going to, the whole group, not just you individually, but the whole group is going to recognize, okay, we've got this rhythm to everything. And so pacing, like what Jess is saying, is like that gets that can be very important for certain types of games, or for, you know, if that's what you're trying to do, if that's your intent with the game design, is to have that be well defined. One of the things, my train of thought just stopped moving.
It derailed.
If I think of it, I'll pop back in, so I'll stop talking now.
No, like I said, the games that fall the most flat for me are the ones that don't feel like they have those balance in those other ways. Like, I want to make sure that I don't want to spend more time in the game figuring out what I want to do or what I can do than actually doing things. And like, that's the balance that I care about. I also care about whether I feel like, and I mentioned this before, do I feel like I am I spending enough time being challenged versus just outwardly succeeding? Because I also don't like a game where I am like, I'm just kicking ass the whole time and nothing bad ever happens to me. If I do that, I just live my real life, you know, where everything is great. Opposite is true too. If I wanted to play a game where I'm just getting my ass kicked the whole time, I'm that's why I'm not like super drawn to games where I'm like, I have no moment where I'm really cool. I don't mind if I die in just the end, but at least
running for your life all the time.
Yeah. and I don't really care about whether another player has more power than me, or that they can do different things than me. I want other people to be able to do different things, which is why I like a game like a Powered by the Apocalypse game, where the characters are supposed to be in a well-designed Powered by the Apocalypse game. They're supposed to have their own specialties, their own things going on. But it's not really asymmetrical. I can pronounce that word, asymmetrical. It's not really asymmetrical in a Powered by the Apocalypse game, because the, like, again, like, when this happens, you do this, when this happens, you do this kind of play is, it's the same amount of engagement throughout the whole thing. I do think that D&D tends to be a little asymmetrical in what you're doing and engaging with the mechanics, at least some of the older versions of the game. I have not played any. I think that there's another, right? D&D 1 is out right now, right? I don't know. But like with 3.5, for example, you are engaging with mechanics in a different way compared to 4.0, where you weren't, fourth edition, where you weren't. Everyone's kind of doing the same thing. I want a little bit of diversity in my gameplay. I think that that's also another form of balance, like a recipe too, Spencer, to continue to follow along with your metaphor. If everything in my recipe is equally balanced, I'm going to have a really shit meal. Sometimes you just need a little bit here and there to make it different, especially since we're all different players. Thinking about my students again.
I think that you comparing D&D 3.5 to 4th edition, I think it was an apt comparison, because I think 3rd edition, 3.5, were very asymmetrical in their game design, like fighter versus most of the magic users, most of the spellcasters. And then I think one of the big, but, and that's what D&D players kind of expected. That's what the game's been a lot of the time. And then fourth edition came out, where everybody kind of used the same. We've got, you know, encounter and daily and at will abilities, and they're all the same kind of progression, even though they're all different flavors. Mm-hmm. And I think people looked at that and they didn't necessarily use the term too symmetrical, but it was too symmetrical for a lot of the audience, because the mm-hmm. audience expected wizards to be able to do all these things, and fighters are much more simple. So, and ostensibly, hopefully, that maybe that's what they were thinking. Fifth edition kind of helps, you know, kind of hits a middle mark where there's some level of symmetry with certain things, but there's still, you know, very specific things that characters are, you know, have much more. And more access to more stuff, because like wizard spellbooks are just inherently always like, you've got a lot of stuff. The more stuff you can put in your spellbook, the more options you have. But it's not quite as wild as it was in the third edition days, when like they kind of gave like fighters versus like wizards were so incredibly different. I remember a friend of mine who interviewed for a game design position. During third, it was like the third edition era. And one of the questions they asked when he got to like the interview was, what's the most powerful class? And the simply asking that question tells me the game is asymmetrical. The game is like, there's certain classes that just have too much cool, whatever stuff. And they ask you and tell us your answer and why, like, why do you think it is? And that was it was more about the why for the question. It was to gauge like how you approach game design and what you're thinking about when you're playing D&D. But I found that a very interesting question, because the people making the game obviously realized that, like, if you say like, which is the most powerful class, and everybody says, well, none of them, like, they're all kind of relatively, they just different flavors, like, that would be a very different answer than if somebody automatically, for the record, his answer was druid, because they have all the clerical spell capability and healing and everything, and once you hit a certain level, wild shape was ridiculous, especially with the right feats, because
you're gonna cause a fight, Craig. I'm just saying
That was his answer, his response, his personal opinion about the druid at a certain point in the druid's life cycle in third edition, whenever the druid was like, oh my god. And I remember seeing those conversations online, saying like that the cleric and druid were like the most powerful character capabilities, just because they do have good offensive spell casting, and they have all this utility stuff, and then they also have healing, which no other character really could do inherently, all those things very well. So, but that's what they wanted, you know, for each of those classes to be, and it made very different experiences. So, and I also remember what I was thinking about when Jess, you were talking about playing a, like a solo game where it felt like you were repeating things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a fine intent for a game anyway, for certain, especially for like solo games, because I saw a thing online here just within the last couple of weeks talking about, and they were talking about a study, and I don't remember what the study was, but basically it broke down to the idea that there's a lot of people like to rewatch old TV shows that they love, and they're not like engaging to learn to enjoy the story and enjoy the twists and turns because they know the story and the twists and turns, but there's a repetition and a comfort that comes with being exposed to this thing that you really love. And you can just kind of, you know, that's the whole cozy gaming thing where I can just hunker down and like, there's not going to be like a great big win power battle condition, but I'm going to be like, I'm going to do this kind of cool thing, and I'm going to go explore this area, and I'm going to use this cue or this card flip or whatever to build my character or to build the scenario. And I'm going to do it over and over and over. And that's very comforting to some people.
If that's the intention of the game.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Right. But if you're playing a game that was clearly not trying to do that, but right. ended up doing that,
exactly.
That's a little rough.
Exactly. That was what was rough for me. Yeah. As we're wrapping up here, Spencer, do you have any final advice for game designers who are trying to come up with a perfectly balanced game?
Stop what you're doing. Stop. delete that section from your rule book. I think we alluded to this earlier, and I think we just hit it again here in this last part, which is like truly understanding what your game is about. And I think writing that out overtly is going to be helpful to you as a designer and to anybody who interacts with your game, right? If the intention of this solo game is to go through a repeatable cycle that is comforting and or at least familiar, and there will be a slow burn or a slow sense of progression, and we're all aware of that from the beginning, then like we're cool. But if you think the game is about something else and your mechanics aren't informing that, and you haven't sort of written something that helps you marry those two ideas together, I think your players will have the dissonance. You'll have the people like Jess who will be like, well, this isn't exactly what I think this is supposed to be about, or right. the experience that I'm supposed to be going into. So, you know, we many people will make fun of the what is a TTRPG section. And I don't think you need that, but I do think you need what is this game in your book, because that will help you understand what is this game on so many different levels, including many of the things that we talked about today. What is this game expectations? What are the roles in this game? The expectations of those roles. Is this a power fantasy? Make that overt. Is this the opposite of a power? What is a power? What's the opposite of a power fantasy? Power.
I'm not going to say what's on my mind. I'm not going to say it.
Yeah, right. We all know.
We're all getting into sub-dom realm here, everybody.
If it's that, then it's that. But like, make it overt, because by writing it on the page, you help guide yourself and whoever eventually interacts with your game. Hopefully, then there's a harmony between the sort of experience that you've created and the different ways that it can be balanced and how other people experience it. And don't worry about power balance in fights. It's a fool's errand and it is not realistic in any way, shape, or form. But that's my hill that I'll die on.
Especially
I'm gonna
if you're
make my game called Fool's Errand.
Especially if you're putting out splat books and you're going to keep adding abilities and feats and magic items and equipment and whatnot, because at some point you're going to lose track of something and there's going to be a power combo. And you know, there are some people that's their fun is finding those combos. Their fun is finding the thing that breaks the game.
In this economy. Can't happen. Spencer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes.
This has been a great conversation. Where can we find you and your work?
My stuff. So I'm Gila RPGs, G-I-L-A RPGs everywhere. So you can find me on Blue Sky there. If you go to GilaRPGs.com, that has links to my store where you can buy printed books, or my itch page where you can get PDFs. It has links to like my mailing list and my Discord. All of that is basically found at gilarpgs.com. So if you go there, you'll find me in whatever way you would like to interact with me.
Wonderful. You can find my games at wannabegames.itch.io. You can find me on Blue Sky. I go by Joska there, or on Discord. I also go by Joska there. And we have a newsletter now that I've written one post exactly for, and it's wannabegames.beehive, spelled with two I's and no E. So you can figure that's your riddle of the day. And yeah, I'll have something coming out for ZineQuest, but I'm not going to announce that right now in case I decide not to.
I did that exact same decision.
And you can find me at nerdburgergames.com. The games are there at the store, including all the fancy schmancy hardcovers for some of the games. Games are also at DriveThruRPG, and I am Nerdburger Craig on Blue Sky. And I think that's what I am on Instagram as well.
All right. Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is I Will by Steph Sachs. It's licensed under Creative Commons. And thank all of you for listening. We'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.